The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, a very good morning. You're very welcome along to the 9 till noon show here in Highland Radio. It's 5 minutes past nine, Thursday, the 29th of August, 24. How are you keeping? I hope you're well, indeed, and hopefully you'll be even better after enjoying 3 hours of top-quality content here on Highland Radio. The lines are open for you to get involved in the conversations. If you want to give us a call, it's 07491 25000, 07491 25000. Caroline, researcher and producer, taking your calls, assisted by Shannon, looking after our social media and other things. Also, if you want to WhatsApp or text, it's 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000. You can send voice notes to that number if you do. That being said, we're not big adopters of that here in the Northwest, but the option is always there for you if it suits you. And also comments at highlandradio.com. And good morning, Marie O'Donnell, the first to say hi on our socials today, because Marie is watching with the hundreds of others that do every single day on our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland, on Facebook, Highland Radio News, Sport and Obituaries, Highland Hub, and on the X platform, Highland Radio. And it's good to have you there as well, and feel free to say hello. It's always good to have that interaction in that space as well. Coming up a little later on, we've got lots of exciting stuff, but you'll know Irish Music Month has been running, and we received dozens and dozens of entries from right across the Northwest and beyond, in fact, because we are going to be selecting a little later on the four finalists, who all win a fantastic prize, by the way, and they will all perform live for us. I'll tell you that in a moment. But anyway, I believe we've got four fantastic acts, and we'll announce who they are later on in the programme. They will then take part in a special live show we have broadcast next Friday morning. We'll be broadcasting live from Ungrianon Theatre, and the acts will be performing live. We'll have other guests. Jimmy and Paul will join me. It's going to be a nice, relaxed vibe in Ungrianon on Friday week. And then we'll select a winner. Us, the judges, the Northwest, will select a winner. They'll go on to represent Ireland, represent Donegal, on a national stage, in a national competition, winning a prize, as I mentioned, a further prize, but also getting that opportunity for huge national exposure. Now, we haven't really fully discussed this here at the radio station, but obviously that means that we're in Ungrianon Theatre. I think we're using the stage, which means there are seats there. So I don't know if you'd be interested in coming along, seeing some live music, seeing the show being broadcast live. Is that something that might interest you? Let us know. Give us a call. We can sort something out. 08 07491 25000. This is something we can work on between now and then, if it suits. Hi, Kathy. Kathy's just dropped in on Facebook as well, watching the programme. Right, let's get to the newspapers. Always busy on a Thursday, of course. We'll start with the Tyrconnell Tribune. As farm fury grows over what's described as the fiasco over payment from the new flagship agri-environment scheme, Acres, it's emerged that red tape and delays in payments have added to the chaos, and there is widespread bemusement with Simon Harris talking up the role of the farmer while failing to see the deficits his government has created for them. Harris has played more gigs than the Wolf Tones this summer, but they gave us no good value for our money, said one irate farmer this week. On to the Donegal News. Their lead story, concerns have emerged that physiotherapy patients will face up to 1 year for an appointment, as the Letterkenny department is working 60% below staffing capacity. A letter by a senior manager to GPs, when seen by the Donegal News, outlines the bleak position for patients and staff within the department. The missive states that Letterkenny Physiotherapy Department, Donegal North Community Health Network, currently has two physio staff out of a complement of five physiotherapists, and with no backfills, this will not improve for at least 1 year. The letter to all GPs in Donegal North, dated August 13th, 24, is an update to correspondence from previous communications dated June 27th of this year regarding the department. So effectively, the physio department there has five staff positions, but only two are filled. There's no option to replace the three that aren't there. So for at least a year, they say. So that's going to be a big problem. It really is. Okay. The Derry news this morning. A second young man from Derry has died following a single vehicle collision in Inishowen at the weekend. Cousins Cian Dawson Kirk, just 16, and Owen Dawson, only 20, lost their lives after the car in which they were travelling crashed at Cross Quigley's Point at 11:15pm on Saturday night. Cian, a student at St. Columb's College, who came from the Carnhill area of the city, was a front seat passenger in the vehicle and was pronounced dead at the scene. His cousin Owen, the driver of the car, died on Tuesday afternoon at the Royal Victoria Hospital in Belfast after suffering serious injuries in the crash. No other vehicles were involved in the tragic incident there. Now on to the Nationals. Let's go to the Irish Times. It seems the government is committed to the banning of phones in schools because they're looking at ways parents or guardians can get in touch with parents in the absence of such a handheld item. Parents who need to contact their children while in class will be advised to leave messages through the school office under new guidance on implementing a mobile phone ban across all schools. The letter from Minister for Education Norma Foley to school managers sets out in greater detail how the ban will operate. It acknowledges that parents may permit their children to carry and access their phones during travel to and from school. It says there should be no access to devices during the school day and they may be placed in lockers. Schools may also may allow phones to be stored in the students' bags during the school day if switched off. If parents need to contact their children for family emergencies or medical appointments, they should leave a message with the school office. Maybe that's, you know, there's a couple of things here. Firstly, I mean, it seems in the first instance a good idea, does it, to have schools phones banned from schools? Students have no use for phones or should have no use for phones in schools, should they? And some should argue it should be banned from the workplace as well. But also to maybe we as parents, it might give us a bit of a break because we can be quite helicoptery, if you know what I mean. And maybe if we can only contact them when it's really important, it gives them a break, gives us a break. I don't know. Maybe there's more benefits to this than just the educational side of it or potentially cyberbullying element to it. School policies should provide for those who need access to their mobile phone for specific regions, reasons, such as students with diabetes who use continuous glucose monitoring with a sensor linked to their mobile phone to monitor blood sugar levels. It says use of tablets, computers and laptops will still be supported and encouraged, providing they are used under the direct guidance of a staff member in the context of teaching and learning and in line with school policies. As I say, do you have a view on that? It looks like it is going to happen, phones being banned from secondary schools. On to the Irish Independent now, and it's kind of a remarkable story, this one. Tusla told prospective foster parents they had to lose weight before they'd be allowed to care for a child. It's emerged that in the middle of a national shortage of care places, the state agency's foster committee had been using inadequate or outdated information on body mass index and weight. Now, this kind of pees me off on a number of levels, not least because we've kind of really got in behind efforts to try and encourage more people to become foster parents because there is a desperate need for more foster parents. And now those that had put themselves forward are being told that, oh, you're too big, or you wouldn't be able to run after a child or what have you. Maybe some might say, well, that should be the case, but we are talking about very vulnerable children that do need care and support, and we've got people coming forward to do so, and they're being told this stuff. It doesn't rest easy with me. Because in one case, the state agency turned down one woman who wished to foster a child based solely on her BMI. Documents seen by the Irish Independent show the woman was told over a virtual meeting by a Tusla staff member whom she had never met that she couldn't run after a toddler. After she complained, it emerged that Tusla Foster Care Committee, which considers applications to be a foster parent, had been relying on an outdated policy document. An internal complaints process found that this led to the committee having a bias. In a statement, Tusla said the guidance was currently being reviewed. Tusla has long considered a prospective foster parent's weight when considering whether they should be approved to care for a child. Now, as I say, we are in desperate times, and that just, as I say, particularly because we've sort of backed that to a great extent through Tusla or independent sort of foster providers. I don't think that's really very fair. It doesn't feel fair to me. Education Minister Norma Foley, this is in the Irish Daily Mail, Education Minister Norma Foley has ruled out any immediate ban on puberty blockers in Ireland following a similar move in the north. Fianna Fáil TD Ms. Foley said medical advice would be paramount in any decision and that parents should have a say in whether their children avail of the treatment. The blockers are sometimes used by those identifying as transgender to delay the effects of puberty, which would mean less treatment or surgery would be required should they decide to change gender in the future. Now, that being said, I mean, if you take... I'm not a scientist, okay, and I'm not sort of... trying to pretend I am, but I mean, if you take this medication, say for instance, you've got male genitalia, I mean, there is development issues there. It's not just then a simple case of reverting back to male and everything returning back to the way it would have been otherwise. And also, we don't allow under 18s to get tattoos, we don't allow under 18s on sunbeds, yet we allow them to take. And should we? This is a question. I haven't got my opinions formulated on this, but we allow them to take puberty blockers, which could have a detrimental impact on them into their later life. Is that the way we should be doing this? Now, puberty blockers are actually used for. And I know that people are in the car and stuff, but say for instance, if a girl would to get early periods. They are used in that regard as well, but this is for a completely different reason. The recent UK CAS report found there was remarkably weak evidence supporting the use of such treatments, prompting a review by health authorities in both Ireland and Britain. A ban was introduced in England earlier this year, preventing the prescription of the medication, which suppresses the natural production of sex hormones to delay puberty from European or private prescribers and restricting NHS provision within clinical trials. This was challenged by campaigners who said they were concerned for the safety and welfare of young trans people in the UK, but the High Court in England ruled the ban was lawful. What's your view on this? And different views as well. I mean, I think the majority of people, because this is a situation that may not actually affect them or their children, would say that we shouldn't go down this route. But there might be those of you out there that believe that this is the right thing for this government to do, to not immediately ban puberty blockers in Ireland. Yeah, I'd have a serious bit of thinking to do in that regard, to be honest with you, if I were in that situation. Irish Farmers Journal, factories look set to scramble for cattle. A number of the larger beef processors have moved this week to ensure that their feedlots will have cattle ready for the factory ahead of the high-volume Christmas market. The move has injected more life into an already buoyant trade, with bullock prices seeing big gains in March this week. Prime cattle supplies have seen a huge drop in the last 4 weeks, with the prime cattle killed back over 10,000 head for the first 4 weeks of August compared with the same period in 2023. Star this morning, a man in his 50s, is due in court this morning after a lady who was badly injured in a two-car collision at the weekend passed away. Elizabeth Cave, who was in her 80s, was one of three people injured in the crash at Inver in the south of the county on Sunday morning at 9 a.m. It came just hours after another serious collision in the Inishowen Peninsula, which we talked of a little earlier on. Gardaí said last night that the arrested man had been charged and would appear before Letterkenny District Court this morning. What do you think about this? I mean, obviously, you know, if you head to down to Ireland West or into Derry or up to Belfast, down to Dublin, or you're getting on a flight and you do happen to take a drink, there is that whole, well, it's 5 o'clock somewhere, and maybe having the gin and tonic or the pint, regardless of what the time of the day it is sort of part of the ritual of heading off. Some might say it wouldn't be, but for others, it's like a session. They go in and they get absolutely loaded. Well, Michael O'Leary has called for a 2-drink limit for passengers at airports to stop violence on flights. Now, what do you think about this? The Ryanair boss says a restriction on alcohol before boarding could help combat a surge in in-flight assaults. He said, "We don't want to begrudge people having a drink, but we don't allow people to drink drive, yet we keep putting them up in aircraft at 33,000 feet. It's not that easy for airlines to identify people who are inebriated at the gate, particularly if they are boarding with two or three others. As long as they can stand up and shuffle, they will get through. Then when the plane takes off, we see the misbehaviour. So, I mean, obviously on the face of it, that seems like a good idea, doesn't it? But are Ryanair going to still sell booze on the plane? Is it all right to get loaded as long as he's getting the money for it? Also, too, of course, some people might bring duty-free on. I presume you can crack the top of that and have a guzzle. Well, Mr. O'Leary said the airline is probably dealing with at least one bad case of assault on a weekly basis now, up from almost zero 10 years ago. He said crew members and other passengers have become targets, with delays adding to the problem as people are spending time in airports drinking before they board an aircraft. So, would you back Michael O'Leary in his calls for a 2-drink minimum before you can get on a plane? Now, 2 drinks could send one person over the edge and not fill the teeth on another, but anyway. And finally, are you nostalgic about any foods as a young person? Angel Delight, apparently, is the most likely to whisk us back in time to our childhood. The dessert mix, which came out in 1967, was the most nostalgic dish for a third of people in the survey. Celebrity friends, fans of the treat, which turns into a sweet mousse when whisked with milk, include, who cares, but anyway, pop mogul Simon Cowell and chef Nigel Slater. So the top 10 foods that remind us of our childhood, and I want to hear your foods that remind you of your childhood. Dumplings remind me of my childhood. Dumplings, and it's not all good memories either. Angel Delight, Mr. Whippy, jelly and ice cream, chip chop fish and chips, fish fingers, boiled eggs and soldiers, salt and shake crisps, wagon wheels, cola bottles, rice pudding. That's the top 10 from 1 to 10. That sounds a bit boring. I'm sure we can come up with better than that. What food reminds you most of your childhood? What brings you back? As I say, for me, I think it would be a dumpling. But I don't know what it might be for you. It's a bit of fun. You can break up the other stuff we're talking about. So let me know, what are your most nostalgic foods? What food do you eat that brings you straight back to your childhood? And we, is after you've been fed as a baby, all right, from after being fed as a baby onwards, what food brings you back to your childhood most? As I say, for me, probably dumplings, but for others, the top one, Angel Delight. Okay, well, each to their own. Text back in saying, Greg, I texted you on Tuesday. You were making inquiries and getting back, but I had to go out and didn't hear your reply. It was about the smart meters. They're coming back to me. I refused the first time and asked, could I refuse the second time? Or what's the story? Sorry for asking again, and thank you. Well, we generally fulfil our commitments, and we're doing so today through Carmel O'Connor, smart meter business project manager with ESB Networks. Good morning, Carmel.
Morning, Greg.
Listen, I suppose in the first instance, you are literally, you know, responsible for the rollout, or part of a team responsible for the promotion and rollout of smart meters. So obviously your default position is that everyone should get one of these, because it's the way we're going. So maybe we'll start with that. I mean, where are we at in terms of, you know, a percentage of smart meters installed versus the total amount of meters out there?
Yeah, well, at the moment we have over 1.8 million smart meters rolled out, and we expect to be at about 2 million, 2.1 million by probably the middle of next year. So as things go, it's a really, really successful project, because we're even with slowdowns like COVID and things like that, we've managed to get the smart metering program up and running and delivering for customers. I suppose since 2021, customers have had access to different smart metering tariffs. And if you even look at the CRU's website, they will tell you that a standard smart tariff is now the best tariff to be on. And if you don't have a smart meter, then obviously you can't avail of those smart tariffs. And there's lots of them out there. If you look at any supplier's websites, they have different tariffs that can absolutely help a customer to save money, whether they go for a free Saturday or Sunday, or maybe don't use their electricity at peak times and move to off peak. And you couldn't do that without a smart meter. And the other thing that we've done with in the last few years is we've now got a networks online account. So a customer can go in and have a look at that account and actually download their half hourly information without the supplier. This is before they change anything, without talking to a supplier. They can go in, they can see there's a new bar chart that will tell a customer whether they're using their electricity during the day, at the peak time, at night. And we have a harmonized downloadable file. It's basically a spreadsheet that you can download, that a customer can download, and they can go to a number of switching sites with that information. And that information will actually tell a customer what's the best tariff for them, the way they use it now, But I think the beauty of it is, and the one of the main drivers for smart metering is to let customers know if you're using it from the at peak time when it's more expensive to generate, when you're bringing on those carbon fuels, that you can actually change the way you use your electricity, and that can save money and it's better for the environment. So all of those things are enabled by smart meters. And of course, there's other people that are getting their smart meter because they've gone and they've got themselves solar panels. And if they're exporting, like if they're exporting to the grid, so they're not using maybe all of the electricity that they're generating with their solar panels, they can get paid for that export because it's been metered through a smart meter. So
the position, I get you, but the position as it was, listen, there's no going back now, I get you, but just bear with me if you don't mind. The position where it was, where we all had our analog meters, you know, whether you liked it or not, it was quite simple. It does seem that if you want to get the benefit from a smart meter, that it is, there's quite an awful lot of processes to go through. You really have to dig into it, between downloading documentation, comparing websites, seeing which is best for you, changing your electricity usage habits. Like, do we hear, when people are frustrated with that, do we hear from a sort of a noisy minority, or do you recognise that, you know, to maybe get benefits from smart meters, it can be a little bit complicated?
I wouldn't say it's complicated, because if somebody decides to do absolutely nothing, at best, your meter is there, and the ESB networks are pulling that meter reading every couple of months, and you have an accurate bill, so no more estimated bills. So that's if you do absolutely nothing, right? So if you just let us exchange your meter for the latest technology, which is 2G or 4G, if the 2G signal is poor in a particular location, there's no more estimated bills. And even that idea of estimated bills, where maybe a meter reader hasn't got to a location, and suddenly a few months later, a customer is getting bill shock because they're getting a catch-up bill, all of that is gone without doing anything whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But what I will say to you is that we've done a recent survey of the customer online account, just to see how people are finding it. And 82% of customers have said that they have found it easy to use, are very easy to use. And 89% of the customers who have used the downloadable file have found it very useful, the graphs, because we've made it as simple as we can. Mm-hmm. Like, you literally go in. So you just need your account name and the mobile phone number that you have given to your supplier. It takes only a couple of minutes to create a Networks Online account, link your MPRN, and then you have your data. And it's important to say that your data is your data. Nobody else has access to that data but you, so your data is protected. I know, look, I'm in smart metering a long time, so I probably I can't understand necessarily why people have a fear of smart meters, because they're like, it's not just that it's a legal requirement, like that's because we're the Irish government have there's a piece of legislation that says, look, let's get smart metering in, and it's across Europe, because the drive is to improve move people off the peak. Mm-hmm. By giving them that information, help people to lower their bills by giving them information. So I think most people, once they take a couple of minutes to log on, create their account, what we find is, now obviously we don't know who's using it, but we can see the statistics of how many people are constantly logging in. Okay. So you can see that somebody is not just logging on once and never going near it again. People who have created accounts, they're going in on a regular basis and checking. And I think if it was difficult, they wouldn't be doing that. Okay. They're actually finding the information useful.
So if I have a smart meter now, right, is every bill that I get based completely on my usage?
Yes.
Okay. No, just, it's no more estimated bills or anything like that. Each bill represents my electricity usage.
Yes. Okay. Once it has connectivity, there's a very, very small percentage, and I'm talking tiny, a small, really small percentage, where we may not have comms. It could be
It's not pinging back or something.
And it's mainly, I have to admit now, at the moment, it's mainly meters that are in the basements of apartment blocks, but if you were in a really poor connectivity area. But if you have, and you will know that from your bill, because your bill will say, you know, what your comms is. And it, so for, I think, 98% of customers, it's a completely accurate bill.
A caller says the people who read the meters will lose their jobs after these smart meters are installed. They'll be missed by many people for many reasons. Like, I mean, obviously, you can talk to that if you like. I think sometimes maybe people don't realise how extensive the rollout already is. I think some people are sort of talking about smart meters as if it's something coming down the track. But 1.8 smart meters are already installed now. So whatever the implications of that might be, and we don't want anyone losing their jobs, we're well down the road here in terms of smart metering. But do you want to reference that about the threat to jobs and what have you?
Well, yeah, I admit smart meter readers. Now, meter readers will still be there for certain types of metering, but there's other jobs are created as a result. So, yes, manual meter reads we may not be sending out. And you're right, like we've already over 75% of the meters exchanged and at 1.8 million out of a total of over 2.4 million meters. We're well on the way. But smart metering data brings up other opportunities in other areas. So
I don't think I've heard of any redundancies. I mean, has there been smart meter reader redundancies?
Well, they're not actually employees. So some people were on contracts.
Understood,
contracts,
and they weren't necessarily renewed. Okay. So in terms of, there's another couple of questions coming in though, Colm, but to address the listener's point directly, I mean, obviously you are of the view, why would you refuse the installation of a smart meter?
Yeah.
But are we still at the point whereby you can refuse the installation of a smart meter? And are we getting close to the point now whereby, will that technology you have is no longer being supported or serviced or what have you? So where are we that in the lifespan of refusing the new meter?
Yes, like as I have said before, at the moment, there's a legal requirement on ESP networks to exchange all smart meters. But if a customer says, at this point in time, I don't want a smart meter, so they send us in a letter or an email or a phone call to the call center, giving their name, their address and their MPRN number and say, I don't want a smart meter at this point in time. We won't be pushing it at this point in time. But what we always do is we send a letter out to the customer and we remind them that if their meter breaks down, as you say, some of these meters are old technology. Our network technicians don't have older meters in stock in their vans anymore. So if a customer supply goes because their smart meter has broken, they'll end up having to get a smart meter because that's what we're buying now. That's pretty much what most meter manufacturers are selling. It's practically impossible now to, even if you wanted to get a non-smart digital meter, to get a supplier who supplies a vendor who makes non-smart meters anymore. But you know, like I think we said it, like there's nothing to be afraid of, really.
If the truth is, like, there's certain groups of individuals that put out false information on things.
Yeah.
And there was an awful lot of that in relation to smart meters. They've moved on to the next thing, if the truth be told, because the smart meters have been installed. There's an afterlife of that information that people are leaning on at this time, really, if the truth... You know, I mean, I think very specifically myself, and I can see that's exactly what's happening here. The people that were dead against these meters have moved on to the next thing that they're dead against. And those that are still resisting are sort of relying on old information that
I think you're right, because like the meters have, there's no health issues, there's no data concerns, and they are the sort of thing that people are doing. But you said one of your customers said they got a second letter. I'll tell you, there's a couple of reasons why you might have got a second. You might have seen a letter. First of all, we've now got a smart day night meter, so we're sending out letters to customers who have a day-night meter that they may not have got letters before. Sometimes if a customer has changed supplier, there's a little flag on our system and sometimes that gets reset. So the customer could have got a second letter because of that and they just have to come back to us. But we're also noticing that there's a lot of customers out there who previously said they didn't want a smart meter. And now they're coming back and they're saying they want one. So we've put a link on our website. So again, if somebody wants a smart meter who had previously said no, and we have more of them. Some of them are customers that have put solar panels in. Others of them now have heard of different tariffs. They have friends and neighbours who've had a smart meter, have had no issues with the smart meter, but know somebody who's got a really good tariff with their supplier and they're looking for them. So we have a link there. So there could be a couple of reasons why a customer would have said no and would have got the letter again. But if they still don't want it, they can just write into us. But
you have indefinite.
I'd say why.
Yeah. Do you have indefinite access to the 2G network, just out of interest, because I know there's been some talk of realignment.
Yeah, the 2G network, I mean, we're planning that if it does go, we have a plan in place. So, I mean, the signals are that at some stage in the future, 2G will be gone. But all of the new meters that we're installing also work on 4G. Mm. So there's a backup. And for the ones that are 2G only, look, sure, we'll get to them when we have to. But like, thankfully, it's a good few years away.
Is it definite, says a listener, that there are no damaging effects caused by the wireless? Are there no health implications with smart meters?
I would say there are none. All of the information we have, and we have a lot of health information on our website, says that, like, tells you the rules, the International World Health Organization kind of values of different emissions, all of that. And the smart meters we have are like a teeny tiny percentage of that. Like, it's not just, it's just within, it's well,
but it's
within.
Really just effectively texting, isn't it? From the meter.
It is. That's it, exactly.
So in my text. Like, and as I say, I'm not here to back you up or whatever, but we have to be realistic in relation to this.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a number of TVs in my phone that are running off Wi-Fi. I've got my phone in my pocket on 5G. I've got three or four smart speakers all pinging Wi-Fi. My house is literally, if it's bad for me, I'm banjaxed, because it is smothered in radio signals, if the truth be told. And I couldn't get too excited about a box outside the house exchanging the odd bit of data. And that's just me, to be completely honest, because if I was living off grid and I was worried about that stuff, well, maybe you could start talking about it there. But there's so many radio waves bouncing through the houses, I can't see how this could have any impact. What about the older generation with no broadband or internet? How they'd be affected in the future? I think there's a bit of a misconception as well that you're obliged to engage with smart meters and all their functionality. Effectively, it just sits on your wall, does it not?
That's it.
And does the same job that your old meter did, unless you want to try and benefit from it.
Exactly that. I think you hear some people saying, activate your meter. Now, it's not activated. As soon as the meter goes in, it's got a 30-day proving period. And within 30 days, we know whether the comms are working or not. And like I say, in 98% of meters, they are. Where it doesn't work, we send a meter reader, the same as we always did every 2 months. But if a customer does absolutely nothing, what they will get is accurate meter readings, because we'll be pulling the meters and you'll never have another estimated bill again. But if you want to create your network's online account and download the data and start viewing it, but more to the point, if you want to start using that data and going to all of these switching sites that are out there, like, there's lots of them. Like, it's amazing how many of them have already grown up. I think the SEAI and UCD person has just come up with a new one, and there's a few others that I can't even remember.
And they'll take
your harmonized downloadable file, which is basically a spreadsheet, and they will list all of the different prices of all of the different suppliers that are out there. And it really gives you, I think it empowers you as a customer.
But the consumer is ultimately responsible there. And, you know, if you do dig into some of those packages, you're responsible for the network, of course. You have to make sure that some of the costs go up during the day and the reductions at night. That might not suit you. So have a proper look at it to see if you want to go
Absolutely.
Down that route.
Oh, yeah. And I think that's what I'm saying. Like, the harmonized downloadable file tells you what you're doing right now. So those websites can show you something, like, because you know yourself, if you listen to the Commission for the Utility Regulator, the CRU, there not enough people look at different suppliers and don't switch. I think we're all guilty of we're happy with our supplier, we don't look around. Whereas I suppose this is just more information to help customers.
Just a minute, I won't keep you much longer. What's the difference between 107 and 108 meters?
Oh, so the Aurum 107, that's your 24-hour. So you would have had a 24-hour meter and we would have put in a 24-hour. So it's a like-for-like exchange. And the Aurum 108 is the day-night meter. So it's the day-night meter.
Is one better than the other?
Oh, they're the same. They're the same. It's just we don't, again, not to inconvenience customers. If a customer was already on a day-night tariff, we did a like-for-like exchange. So they're basically the same meter, but one of them has two registers, a day register and a nighttime register, so that if the customer didn't want to change to, say, a day night peak register or go to a free Saturday or Sunday, they don't have
can
to.
A 107, so though, can a 107 still switch to a day night option if they wanted to?
So the 107 can switch to a day night peak, or it can switch to the half hourly. So the half hourly means you literally have every half hour and you can have a range of different tariffs. Whereas if you just go day night peak, that's your standard smart tariff. It's 5 to 7 p.m.
Okay. I was asked yesterday, so a bit of reading, even though I have a smart meter for over a year.
That's, well, unless it's one of the meters that is not communicating. So most of the customers, most bills tell you whether the comms, it has a, what we call comms technically feasible. So that's if that's a one, it's poor. But other than that, like, so if you have a two or three or four, so maybe again, if somebody rings our call center with an MPRN and asks them to check the comms, they can do that, or Greg, if you want to get the MPRN and email me, I can find out and check. But a phone call to our call centre or to the supplier will tell you.
But if that listener themselves actually just will do this for them, if they want to send on that MPNR to us, we'll pass it on to you directly and you can check.
Perfect.
And in other words, they'll get a good, sharp answer. I'm not saying your colleagues won't be as sharp, but you know what I mean. All right, Carmel, listen, thanks for your time this morning. I do appreciate it. Take care of yourself.
No problem, Greg.
Bye-bye. Okay, see you
bye-bye.
Soon. Carmel O'Connor, Smart Meter Business Project Manager with the ESB Networks. As I say, you know, the future is here, whether we like it or not. 75% of meters have already been switched out. I would say there's a lot of people, including myself, if the truth be told, that don't know whether the meter was switched or not. But anyway, that's where we're at. But you can still refuse if you wish. Dahi is he's heading back to paraffin lamps. Good man, Dahi. Where are you going to get the paraffin? It's hard to get your hands on these days. What are you going to run the telly on, Dahi? You can't run that on paraffin. Get your own generator as well. But you see, you get your own generator, but then you're going to your local service station who could be ripping you off for diesel. I don't know. Back to school for most children and their families means back to catching a number of viruses and infections that will be spreading in overcrowded, poorly ventilated classrooms, leading to missed school days and what have you. We're joined on the programme now by Kira Steele, who's a concerned mum and a GP, and is asking the question, as parents, why do we accept so much sickness? Because...
Yeah. Hi, Greg. Thanks a million.
Hi, Kira.
Chat to me again. Yeah, I think the last time we were talking about hospitals, but this time it's school. So.
Yeah, so could we be doing more to or wait, well, I'll just let you take it from here, Kira.
Yeah, well, I am a GP, but I'm also a mum, and I'm also a mum of a teacher as well as a mum of students, you know, and, you know, we also have young family members in our family. We're all in the same boat when it comes to, you know, our environments. So like our indoor environments are 90% of our environments, really. And, you know, the school environment is where kids spend really, you know, 6, 7, 8 hours of their day. And becoming unwell is a great concern for parents sending their children back to school. And, you know, this is, you know, even more to the forefront today as we're just going back to school after a long summer holiday. And coughs, colds, flus are a part of that. You know, kids starting creche, this may be the first day of school for some children. And parents have that concern at the back of their mind. You know, when are they going to have to ring in sick themselves because they have to mind children, children who are sick in school. So, like, we want to join the conversation by setting up a sort of advocacy group for clean air in schools. And you can reach that at www.cleanairadvocacyireland.org.
I'll ask you how that might happen and what's the Department of Education's role in it. But what about the notion that, you know, this is good for us? You go in, you pick up, you know, passing blows of certain diseases or colds or viruses or whatever, and it builds up your antibodies and, you get more resilience going forward. You know, because in terms of immunisation, we give people a little bit of what hurts them sometimes. I know that's a basic way of looking at it. And the big fallout from COVID, where we all did sort of try and share clean air, is that we had an awful lot of bounce back of some of these conditions, did we not? Now, you're the doctor, so you can correct me everywhere you wish, Kira.
Well, I suppose all of those things that you've referred to are defence. Whereas if we clean the air in schools and in our indoor environments, that's a protection from becoming infected in the first instance. And I suppose that's where we want to join the conversation and join a narrative of having to accept that. When wouldn't it be absolutely wonderful if there was something that we could do that could clean the air, that could improve CO2 levels in schools, and that would improve concentration, improve attendance, reduce illness, so that we wouldn't have to use those defences to fight illness. Immunisation and vaccination is a really important part of that. But why aren't we cleaning the air? And why are parents accepting that there is something we can do that there is not that's not being done?
And you would imagine too that there's loads of meetings and money spent on future planning if another COVID-19 were to happen. For an example, I mean, we saw children sitting in classrooms freezing with the windows open. One of the arguments, if it's not for the present, maybe could be for the future, that this would help ensure that, God forbid, we had such a situation again, that schools would remain open, because we know how problematic it is if they have to close.
Yeah, I mean, a new pandemic is certain, but we're not just talking about COVID here. You know, the HSE is warning about measles, respiratory virus, RSV, rhinovirus, and chickenpox even is airborne. And it's really to bring in the fact that there are airborne precautions and protections that we can pull into play that we're not using. You know, the World Health Organization is worried that governments aren't promoting all of the efficient tools that we have to protect as well as defend against all of these threats. So what we're trying to say is, why are parents accepting that? You know, kids being sick 4 or 5 times a year, just really, like, it's so disruptive. But we're talking about CO2 in classrooms. We're talking about nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, all of the pollutions that come from bringing air, you know, that come into the classroom for our children that are there for 8 hours a day, when we can be doing something more to protect them.
What do you think the Department of Education should be doing, Kira?
So there was 62 million allocated for bringing filtration, air filtration into the school. And I just want to make a point that ventilation and air filtration are additive in their effect of producing clean air in schools. Ventilation is opening windows and diluting any sort of bioaerosols or other aerosols in the classroom that can affect our kids and cause things like lung diseases, worsen asthma, reduce concentration, affect performance and all of that. And air filtration then cleans particle matter and bioaerosols out of the air. So bioaerosols particle matter can lodge in the lung and cause disease or inflammation. And air filtration can clean up to 99% of these particles and bioaerosols. So why aren't we doing that? So, you know, Vic, in our email to you, which is why we generated this conversation, sort of made the point of, you know, other environments, you know, if we send other, you know, loved members of our family, like, say, for example, our pets into, you know, daycare or minding situations, they come home sick and coughing, we'd complain to them.
Yeah.
So why aren't we complaining? And why are we accepting it? But also want to get across, there's very simple things parents can do. But schools, boards of management, you know, need to take action as well. And the government needs to take action, because board of management need direction from government and parents need direction then as well. But it's not complicated. I think there's an attitude or a narrative that introducing air filtration and ventilation is complicated. It's not. You know, we can open windows, you know, parents can ask for the windows to be open on the bus. We can ensure that windows are open in the toilets in school. And, you know, we can make sure that the buses, you know, are using infiltrated air rather than recirculated air conditioning.
So the argument is that we should be striving to make schools one of the safest places rather than one of the riskiest, obviously, because we know what's going to happen now. Is there any risk that these kind of measures, because of sort of, you know, herd immunity or whatever might happen as a result of lots of people getting lots of conditions, that this could leave more vulnerable children more vulnerable?
Well, vulnerable children is a complicated question. First of all, a lot of, you know, catching virus can induce vulnerability in children. But children who are immunocompromised have a reduced, occasionally a reduced uptake or a reduced immune response to vaccination. And that's why in the vaccination programs, they are vaccinated, you know, more frequently and advised to get boosters in the immunocompromised population, children or adults. So excluding, knowing that, we have to do other things to clean the air. We know masks work, but it's very hard for people to wear masks. So if we're not wearing masks, we need to clean the air. If we're not cleaning the air, we are excluding vulnerable people. You know, so it is a disability issue, but it's also an issue for unions, because healthcare workers and teachers have the highest, you know, rate of long COVID, and they have high absenteeism as well. You know, there was one study, the Precise study is an Irish study, and which showed a high degree of absenteeism in St. James's Hospital. There were 11,000, you know, and days lost by healthcare workers. And in that study, 15% of healthcare workers didn't know that they had COVID. So these things can be transmitted, mm-hmm. you know, without having symptoms, as well as people, having. So that air filtration removes the bioaerosols out of the air in those situations as well.
OK, listen, it's an interesting conversation, and we appreciate you contacting us and coming on and explaining it, Ciara. Thank you so much for your time. That is Dr. Ciara Steele, who is a concerned mum and a GP, and that's her view. What do you think? Do you share her concerns? Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think it's not? 086 60 25,000, because obviously there's going to be probably difference of views within the medical community. Perhaps, I'm not saying there is, but perhaps there might be as well. And there's going to be different views amongst the general population as well. All right, it is the 9 till noon show on your Highland Radio. We'll be back with more after the news and obituary notices.